Okay, we have four cases on the calendar, one of which will be orally argued. The other three are submitted on the record. The purposes of today's recording, the three submitted cases are 2007-3273 Peterson versus Navy, 2007-5141 Morse Cafeteria versus the U.S., and 2008-3032 Whitworth versus MSPB. The orally argued case is Mini-Auction versus Thompson Corporation. Mr. Rainey, you will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning. Whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. We would submit, in light of this court's decisions in BMC Resources and Seagate and the Supreme Court's decision in KSR, all of which issued after the verdict in this case, that the judgment here must be reversed. At a minimum, Thompson is entitled to a new trial in light of the significant changes in the law as compared to the jury verdict.
What is the standard of the Third Circuit for this trial based on the jury instructions?
The standard in the Third Circuit is similar to the standard elsewhere, Your Honor, that we have to show an error in the instructions and we have to show prejudice to the case. And we believe in all three instances we've done that here.
Do you require some additional or different type of jury instructions in order to show prejudice?
No, Your Honor, although in the case of BMC Resources, we did submit an instruction that is attempting to predict what the law was going to be, and the judge refused to give that instruction. Instead, charged the jury consistent with the on-demand case.
We tried to anticipate KSR also.
We tried to anticipate KSR as well, based on the Solicitor General's brief, and the judge refused to give that instruction, preferring instead to give what was the prevailing pattern instructions from the AIPLA.
I'm not sure
the crystal ball correct at that point.
I think we were a little off, Your Honor. But I think Supreme Court precedent as well talks about where there's intervening changes in the law. It's the new law that's applied, and even if we hadn't objected at all, it would be the new law that would govern the facts as before the jury.
I'm not sure we can fault the trial judge for not predicting, since we never know what we're going to do either.
Certainly not, Your Honor. But the question really is, what is the legal significance of the new law? Not whether he or we were correct in terms of what we were predicting. It's our view that this court's decision in BMC Resources, which there is a clear dispute among the parties in this case, that court's case mandates an agency relationship in order for there to be a finding of liability for Thompson.
Can I ask you, on the BMC question, just looking at the claims, one of the points you make, obviously, with respect to bidders is the inputting language.
Yes.
If the inputting language, you know, in BMC we cited, I think, Professor Lumley's article and the suggestion that people just have to reconfigure their claims. It's doable. It's just a matter of drafting. In this instance, if inputting into change to receiving, would that fix your problem with respect to bidders and with regard to that term?
I think these claims could easily have been redrafted to read on a single party, such as Thompson, and they were not.
Let me ask a second question on the joint infringement issue. I hope I can articulate the question so that you'll know what's troubling me here. With respect to the issue, you focus on the parity, what's the parity exclusive versus the parity enabled stuff. And frankly, that struck me as kind of a more infringement damages issue than necessarily a joint infringement, because you were looking at Thompson's alleged infringing device, and you were telling us it can go either way depending on whether it's party enabled or party exclusive. If the party enabled stuff isn't even infringing, then why does that inform our judgment with respect to joint infringement? In BMC, I mean, shouldn't we be looking at the claims themselves and not at the infringing device and how that operates?
Well, I think, to respond to your question, I think the issue is this. These claims require different actors to do different things. And on the issuer side, the issuer has to display and look at bids that were submitted electronically. That is a decision entirely within the purview of the issuer. And you don't even have electronically submitted bids unless the issuer says, I will accept electronic bids with this particular auction. And nearly half of all municipal bond auctions don't have any electronic submissions at all.
But in your view, those would not be infringing, right?
I think that's absolutely clear.
But that wouldn't implicate, then, the joint infringement issue with respect to the claim.
I think that issue really goes to what decision-making ability the issuer has on that side of the process, if you will. I mean, they clearly have a decision they can make, which implicates whether there is infringement or whether there's non-infringement. To me, that's significant in terms of their freedom to operate. And certainly, we have no control at all over whether they accept electronic bids or not. That is entirely the issuer's decision.
But isn't displaying kind of a joint effort? I mean, who's to say who's displaying, the issuer or the server, you know, the Thompson?
No, the issuer has to sit at his or her computer and fire up the computer and log on to the Thompson website and go through the appropriate procedures in order for that information to be displayed. I mean, it's a and there is no display if there's no electronic bids submitted. So that's a decision that they make. And in fact, there's no bids submitted on the bidder's side unless the issuer says ahead of time, I will accept electronic bids in my auction. And then at that point, it's up to the bidder to decide whether they bid. But I'm quite certain that municipal bond issuers like the city of Milwaukee or the state of Tennessee would be quite shocked to learn that they are acting on behalf of Thompson when they auction off municipal bonds. And I think equally unlikely would be J.P. Morgan Chase and other large financial institutions who do the bidding on these would be equally shocked to learn that they're acting on our behalf when they bid. So I think it's very clear here, given the structure of these claims, that under BMC there simply is no infringement.
Have you digressed just a minute on one of your answers to Judge Probst? I thought was very interesting. You acknowledge that these claims could have been drafted to have them address one infringer, if you will, or one actor.
Correct.
And I don't know any reason why Thompson shouldn't be allowed to have the benefit of the law, if that's what the law is, that they could have been drafted but weren't. That's the same problem, of course, that BMC confronted, and the opinion in that case also instructs a little bit about how you could have drafted these claims. I suppose after the BMC opinion, and whatever we may learn from this case, claim drafters will start drafting differently. What about prior claims that have been drafted in the same way? Have you thought about whether the doctrine of equivalence could be a salvageable theory for patentees who have, if you will, misdrafted or at least drafted with multiple parties as actors? Would the doctrine of equivalence work in there?
My answer to that is no, for the following reason. The court in BMC...
I recognize, by the way, that's not an issue with this case, so I'm
correctly
asking you to sort of help me think through what to do about the next cases that are coming up.
The problem, in my opinion, with using the doctrine of equivalence is that doesn't deal with the problem of what 271A means and what Congress intended by the statute. And according to BMC Resources, Congress meant one actor, and I think the doctrine, in fact, relied on some Supreme Court case law on the doctrine of equivalence as informing its decision that it had to be one actor, relying on the all elements rule. So I think what the doctrine of equivalence is looking at is an entirely different issue, which is where you have the potential for a liable party, a single actor, and you make some change to some element of the claims, is that change significant? I think it's looking at a different issue.
Still looking at the one actor.
Yes. I think that's right. So,
would that apply also to other cases which change the law after the patent is issued, like KSR or NACK?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty well settled that when there is an intervening change in the law, that law gets applied retroactively to all cases then pending or still on appeal, as well as cases not yet filed unless the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals says otherwise. And that's was not the case in any of these decisions.
Is there a constitutional deficiency applying a retroactive?
No, in fact, in the Supreme Court, this is pretty well settled. There's a well-known Supreme Court case, Boyle versus United Technologies, which actually this court has applied in cases like Exxon v. Lubrizol and others, that finds no constitutional problem in doing that.
You may have noticed that last week the Supreme Court came out with an opinion in habeas that reopens the whole question of retroactivity in certain kinds of cases. But apparently not as clear on this as you might have liked to call.
But I think that Supreme Court case goes to the issue of allowing the states to apply retroactivity.
That is true.
So that's a sovereign immunity type of an issue. But that's an interesting point, though, whether or not there is a procedural due process or even a substantive due process property taking before you achieve the process.
To my knowledge, that argument hasn't been adopted or embraced by I recall in the Festo chain of cases there was an argument made about that. I believe that it was pretty clear that Festo was applied retroactively to patents, even though a very similar type of concern was raised.
Can I turn your attention to the obviousness question?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
What evidence, you know, you've got a tough burden here on obviousness. What evidentiary weight, if any, do we give to the patent, the fact that the patent examiner in this case explicitly considered the reference? The district court's opinion on JMOL seems to have given that weight. Isn't that entitled to some weight in the obviousness analysis?
I think that in this court's case law, talks about, you know, presumption of administrative correctness, but that doesn't impact on the ultimate burden of proof at trial. The real problem here with putting too much emphasis on what happened at the patent office is the patent office only had about two-thirds of the story. They were missing key pieces of evidence, for example, user manuals, which we've got in the record here, which pretty clearly go through these claim elements, which are not, I would submit, in all fairness, they're not rocket science. And if you read the user manuals, which are dated 1992.
Well, let's assume that hypothetical. Let's assume everything that there was to be had was before the examiner. And the examiner clearly looked at it, and he decides to grant the patent. Then what are we to do in a JMOL situation? And let's assume the weight of trial was all of the evidence went the other way. Every single piece of evidence that came in a trial went the other way. Is that enough? I mean, do we consider that evidence in support of what the patent office did as evidence in support in terms of the weight of the JMOL?
I think this court in the past has not given that any evidentiary weight. It's merely impacted on this, you know, the only comment has been you get a presumption of administrative correctness, but this court reverses jury verdicts on validity all the time where patents were granted. Even where patents were granted over the same, very same piece of prior art.
And even if there was no instance where the prior art is missing.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I would submit in this case, given the admissions that were made in this record and the clear documentary evidence, that there's no reasonable jury could have found that anything other than the web browser, which we concede wasn't part of our old software package, was in the prior art. And so the question really is a simple one under KSR.
Now, moving back to the joint infringement, what's the right standard? Is it a pure agency standard? And direction
I think it has to be a pure agency standard because that is the only way to reconcile BMC with a long line of Supreme Court cases that say when Congress enacts a tort, it does so under the guise of the ordinary common law vicarious liability principles. And unless Congress says you can apply some lower standard of vicarious liability, the Supreme Court has said standard common law agency is the only vicarious liability option.
But pure agency under the common law is not all that simple.
No, the restatement is, I've been poring over the restatement in preparation for this argument, but there are some fundamental basic things.
You don't
things.
Need to restate the restatement.
No, I don't think I could do that.
But you both understand that the common law has a rather flexible view of agency depending upon context and circumstance. are you suggesting that we should be doing the same thing in these cases?
Well, I think BMC, fairly read, actually does invoke, I think, some of the important fundamental basics of common law agency. When you have control over conduct, that is certainly, you know, from law school you learn assent, benefit, and control are the sort of fundamental tenets of agency law, and that's true in the restatement as well.
Does it have to be direct?
Go ahead, Tom.
Does it have to be direct control?
I think it has to be control of the conduct. You have to, I think, a critical component of an agency relationship, this is true, I think, across the board, is that the principal has the power to control the conduct of the agent. And the agent has to be acting on behalf, for the benefit of, on behalf of, which is a very, I think, clear concept, a very special concept within agency. And that all has to be mutually agreed to. And I think that's basically the basic premise. So I think, I'm not exactly sure what direct control is distinct from what I'm saying, but I'm saying there has to be the power and the ability for the principal to control the acts of the agent.
Or direct?
I think the case law uses those terms interchangeably. The Supreme Court certainly does. They say control or direct. I don't think it's meant to be, I don't think there's meant to be a distinction between those two.
Go back to KSR for a second. The old parity reference was in the prosecution. Can we say that the examiner did not properly understand all of the aspects of old parity when it was studied, or the court did not, as explained by Mr. O'Neill? Mr. O'Neill, at least during examination, did indicate that all of the methods, all of the steps, both parity were there except maybe for the value.
That's right, and that's, he's the other side's expert. So I think it's clear from the record that the Patent Office did not have the whole picture. And so the examiner was doing the best job the examiner could do, and certainly we're not faulting the examiner for that judgment. I mean, I think this is a problem that occurs particularly in these kinds of patents where you don't have a wealth of documents and literature and publications for the examiner to pull out of an electronic database. It's a product that was marketed out in the world. So it's a question of how is the examiner going to get the best information about how the product actually operates.
With regard to the jointly acting issue and our review, J-Mall, do we worry primarily about the trial court's instruction to the jury and whether that adequately stated the issue so that the jury was properly instructed, or do we worry more about trying to do what the jury was supposed to have done instead of without any proper instruction?
I think in the first analysis, that is looking to see whether judgment as a matter of law should have been granted. According to Boyle and Exxon, we take the law as it exists now and apply it to the record that was before the jury in that trial. And so in BMC Resources, for BMC Resources, we take that case and apply it to the record and see whether judgment as a matter of law is appropriate. The jury instructions come in if the court feels that JMOL is not appropriate. The next step is to look at the jury instructions and see whether a new trial is warranted in light of the law. So I think the jury instructions are relevant for that second point. I'm well beyond my allotted time.
Can we restore 4 minutes of your rebuttal time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Add some time to Mr. Barrow's presentation. There's 6 minutes of Mr. Barrow's time.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Good morning.
Good morning. Judge Prost asked the question about the inputting step. That's an important step in this process. Two of the steps are carried out by persons other than Thompson. The inputting step is controlled by Thompson. Here's why. They provide specialized software to the bidder. Their software, designed by them, created by them, used to guide that bidder through the process, to assist that bidder in preparing the bid. Screens come up on the computer and they tell you This is the format you would have to use to have the bid.
Excuse me, but is assistance control?
It is control because it guides them, it teaches them, it provides feedback if they make a mistake. It says, caution, you've made a mistake, do it the right way. That's part of the whole control. It verifies the bid parameters. You've put everything in, or you haven't put enough in, or you made a mistake in some way. That's the control.
Well, let me ask you.
Whenever we go online to Amazon or anything else, there's always that screen that says, put in all this information, which I always manage to fail to do, and it flips up and says, wait. When I say continue, it says, no, you can't, because you forgot to put in whatever it is. And so we go through all of that, but I always retain control over how much further I want to go. I don't have to push the continue button. There's no obligation, no cost to me if I don't. So Amazon really doesn't control the question of whether I make an offer or a product.
That's
why
right.
Isn't that the same issue here?
It's different because Amazon doesn't provide specialized software for you that can be used to create the bid. Amazon doesn't provide a contract that you sign that says you must submit the bid in this format. Amazon doesn't provide a contract on the other side for the issuers, for example, that says these are the criteria that you will see when you have a bid. Amazon doesn't order the bid parameters. So you have contractual relationships as well here that weren't present in BMC. You have control that wasn't present in BMC. And there's one other point I'd like to make on this control issue, because the jury instruction that the judge gave was the on-demand instruction. He talked about facilitating, he talked about instructing, he talked about teaching, he talked about connection. He didn't use the word control. We argued and urged the court to adopt the control measure, anticipating perhaps that this court might at some point in time say direction and control. But the important thing, and this is in the record, at A5752 through 5754. In closing argument, I gave the closing. We took the jury instructions and we took the jury through it and we talked repeatedly. In fact, 10 separate occasions in my closing, I said, the issue here is control. Is there control? I said, the law is, as Judge Lancaster said, if you're a person that does the connecting, you're the purpose, you're the person that exercises the control.
So are you suggesting that if there's really an erroneous, a legally deficient jury instruction, that can be cured by closing arguments?
No, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting that is that the issue of control was presented to this jury in the context of the instructions, and the more important
thing
is...
Well, but the instructions say, as I read it, is kind of one of the things that allows you to find the joint infringement. Are they aware of each other's existence and interacting with each other in relation to the electronic auction process? That's not right.
That's not enough.
That's not enough.
That's
so
not
how
enough.
Do we know that whether or not the jury said, well, that's one of the questions that gets you to joint infringement. That's what the judge told us to do. That's what all we find, and therefore we're fine. We're basing our verdict on that.
Well, I think the jury was told, in addition to what Your Honor quoted, that you look at whether it was instructing, whether there's facilitating.
Where is that in the jury instruction?
In the jury instruction, the very you talk about facilitating, instructing,
teaching. The sentence says, is there one party teaching, instructing, or facilitating the other party's participation in the electronic auction process? But my problem with even that sentence is that's exactly what Amazon does for me. Amazon teaches me, instructs me, and facilitates my participation in buying a book from them by putting up the screens that I'm supposed to respond to or put my order in. And you just a minute ago said, no, no, that's different. But I don't see how the language, is there one party teaching, instructing, or facilitating the other party's participation, cures this instruction at all.
Well, I
think it does.
I think that the instruction clearly says directing. I think instructing, teaching, facilitating is directing. It doesn't say control. But I would suggest that, and this court has said repeatedly, on JMOL, the jury instructions become somewhat, if not totally, irrelevant. What you look at is there substantial evidence to support the verdict? And I think counsel conceded that. Is there substantial evidence to support the verdict under the law, as this court has now articulated? We didn't have the benefit of BMC. If we had the benefit of BMC, we would have tried the case with that instruction. But I don't think it would have made any difference, because substantial evidence supports the verdict of this jury under the BMC standard. There was evidence of direction, evidence of control. Indeed.
Even if the inputting step was done by the bidder, essentially, is done independently of Thompson.
The inputting step.
There's no information in the records to the bidding process itself from the bidder going into the system.
Well, there
Thompson
is.
Thompson does not tell them what to bid.
No, they don't tell them the amount to bid. They tell them the format. They tell them how to put it together.
The system tells them how to format, just like eBay.
Well, I think
it's format in a particular manner.
Well, it's different than eBay. If you go through this sequence, this contractually required sequence of steps, and eBay doesn't sign a contract that says you must supply this data to me in this way, or you're disqualified. This is an auctioneer that sets the rules for the auction. And the rules have to be complied with. If you don't comply with the rules, your bid will not be considered. Your bid will not be submitted. That's the ultimate control. This is the auctioneer. And I think one has to step back and look at it in that light.
If Sotheby has an auction and they prescribe the rules, if I'm a bidder in a Sotheby auction and I raise my paddle, a particular point in time, that means that I've made a bid.
Correct.
Does that mean that Sotheby has instructed me to do it that way? That's the
no, I don't think
that I would have to follow in order to make the bid.
Yeah, I don't think we could say that they've instructed you to raise the paddle or they've instructed you as to the amount that you bid. That's not the controlling step, but one has to look at the step that's defined in the claim of the patent. And it says, inputting the bid to the server, effectively, that's operating.
Well, when I raise my paddle in the auction, I'm inputting my bid?
Yes, you are.
Without any control from Sotheby?
Well, if they define the rules, and they define the criteria, and they guided you through the process, and they provided a computer screen for you to do it, that is, this is the software that I give you, specialized software, not software you can go buy, and we have a contract. Seems to me that satisfied BMC. If BMC requires that you have to tell a bidder what the amount of the bid is, then there's absolutely no way that that's not.
Well, yes, but now you're touching on Mr. Rainey's point. I was wondering what your response to that is. Mr. Rainey suggested that your inventor could have drafted these claims, assuming the inventor drafts, my understanding. Your inventor could have drafted these claims so that they were all done by a single actor. And he suggested that your claims are basically flawed in that respect. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I think with hindsight, one can always say you could write claims better or different. With the benefit of BMC, yes, I would say, sure, you could have written the claims in a different way, but that's not what BMC said. BMC said, didn't say that you must rewrite claims and the claims must be written in a way where a single actor does each of the steps. What BMC said, at least in two of the, I shouldn't tell this court, two of the judges here were on BMC. But as we read BMC.
I wasn't known as a supernumerary.
Okay. The BMC case, as we read it, seems to say, look, there are instances where vicarious liability exists. It doesn't have to be an agency relationship. It has to be one where that person, that entity, that is responsible for the acts of this third party, direct or control, and it's or control. And we think, in this instance, there is overwhelming evidence of direction and control. And that evidence was presented to the jury and was argued to the jury as the basis for its verdict.
Just to discuss BMC a little bit, do you think that it specifically requires an agency relationship?
No, I don't think it does. It doesn't. The restatement, I've studied the restatement a bit too, and it obviously doesn't deal with patent-type situations, but one of the examples it uses as to an agency relationship is a cook who's hired to work in a restaurant. The restauranteur doesn't say, you have to use this recipe and you have to put it in this menu, but the restauranteur provides all of the tools and all of the things necessary to carry out the acts of the cook. That's an agency relationship. But I don't think in BMC it required an agency relationship. As we read it, at least, it says, you're responsible, and vicarious liability exists, if you direct or control. Here there's clear instruction. There's clear teaching. Unlike BMC, and this case could be laid side by side with BMC, there was no evidence presented of control in BMC, at least that's what this court said. There wasn't a factual record developed.
There was no
that was on summary judgment.
There was no direct control. On the record shown.
That's right. But here there was evidence of direct control. There was evidence here that software, specialty software, was supplied. That wasn't the case in BMC. There was a contractual relationship, written contracts in this case, not present in BMC. There was instruction and direction as to how you use the data here that didn't exist. There were written instructions of what you have to do. That's instructing and directing that person on what to do. There was guidance throughout the entire process provided by Thompson, not present in BMC. There were four separate entities that had to be controlled in BMC, only two here. And the process doesn't stop in BMC if the computer goes off on the central server.
But
here it does.
Going back to the second example, when I go into an auction, I understand that there's going to be an overage to the auctioneer. That's a contractual relationship that is written into the agreement anytime you walk into the auction. Does that make me an agent of the auction house? Can I bid on it just because there's a contract between the bidder and the auction house?
Well, if the process step that's defined requires inputting data and you tell them how to input that data, then I would say for purposes of that, carrying out that step, you're an agent. In the example you've given, Your Honor, I'm not sure I would, because I think that's different than what occurs here.
Right, in this example, they give them the paddle, and they tell them this is the way things go here. You've got a bid, and a bid raises paddle. Why is that different than this?
Because
they give them instructions about how to operate within the system.
Well, it's different because here you are guiding, instructing, telling a person how to do it in writing as part of the specialty software that they get. Now, I suppose you could say, well, the auctioneer sets the rules. That doesn't make you an agent for the auctioneer.
Yeah, he sets the rules and he tells you what you have to do to follow them.
Yeah, and I think that in that instance, if there were a claim written under the appropriate parameters of writing claims that required an inputting step, and there was sufficient direction and control, I think the MC would apply. Otherwise, you're wiping out any vicarious liability.
I suppose you could make the argument that in this Sotheby's case, if the arson doesn't make his living buying and selling at auctions, the contractual obligation is rather limited and not really very binding. But if there was a party at the auction house whose living depended on their participating in the auction, and that person could be considered an actor, an agent of the auction house in the process of a joint commercial enterprise. But I suppose you could make the argument that the parties in these transactions are indeed related commercially in that sense. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. I wish I had thought of that, but I agree with that. I think, quite frankly, when you have a contractual relationship, and that's something that the court mentioned as being absent in BMC, you have a written contract that says, if you want to bid on this municipal bond, if you want to participate in this process, you've got to follow my rules. You've got to follow my procedures. You have to format that bid in the way I tell you to do it. And it has to be the way I say it's put together. I'm not telling you what the amount is, but I'm telling you how you have to do it. And I'm instructing you, I'm advising you, I'm guiding you, and if you make a mistake, I tell you, correct it. And that's in writing. And if you don't comply on that end, you're out. Your bid will not be considered.
You explain probably the way every single auctioneer operates, where the auctioneer sets the rules, and you supply the information inputting the bids on that particular purpose. Well, that's the way an auction works, doesn't it?
I think, obviously, there are close parallels to an auction that you might have at Sotheby's or someplace. But I think it goes well beyond that traditional auction of the type that we think of. Because I'm not so certain, and I haven't been to any of those kind of auctions. I've been to a church auction or something like that, which is a little less formal. But I don't recall ever having to sign a contract that says, if I don't raise my paddle to this level, then and raise it in a timely manner. Timing is another thing here. The claims talk about, I keep the clock. One of the things that was happening here is, under the old system, people would send in bids on faxes, and they'd say, I was on time because my fax machine said it was on time, but the other guy's fax machine said it didn't. They are the central timekeeper. So they determine how much time there is, and whether, not only must you submit the bid in a particular format, but you have to submit it on a timely basis. It's part of the rules. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I want to turn our attention to obviousness.
Okay.
Exhausted the infringement issue.
Sure.
I've got two areas that I have questions on. One is that in your brief, you say important trial evidence, notably the admissions of Thompson's own witnesses, showed that Old Parity did not perform at least four of the method steps required by independent claim law.
Correct.
The evidence you cite in the appendix to support that, as I read it, so you can tell me if I'm wrong, is simply the fact that during trial, Thompson's witnesses tried to set up some discat or some experiment or something, and the network flopped and it didn't work. So to the extent they admitted anything, they admitted that because this network wasn't hooked up right, they couldn't show what they had planned to show. But I didn't read anything you cited as being an admission that Old Parity did not perform those steps. So can you tell me what I'm missing here?
Yes, I think Mr. Bradner, Dr. Bradner's testimony, based upon his report. Bradner's testimony, as I recall it, based on his report, admitted that a number between four and seven of the claimed elements were not present.
Okay.
I'll get the site here in a moment. And those included the true interest cost calculation, verification of bid parameters. That's at A4866.
What you cite, why don't you look at your brief on page 29, because that's where the statement I just quoted comes from there. And you have two appendices cited in connection with that. And if there's more you want offered, I'm happy to hear that too.
That's in connection with Mr. Landis's testimony.
Yes, so
Mr. Landis was the man that had the disc. In the opening statement, they held up a disc like this.
So did he admit that Old Parity didn't have those elements, or did he just acknowledge that it was obvious this experiment during the trial blew up and didn't work?
Well,
he characterized this as an admission that Old Parity did not perform at least four steps, and I'm trying to find that.
The point that was made is this. They held up this disc and they said, we will show that this disc will operate it, we're going to perform it before you. We'll make the invention as obvious as the nose on your face. And I asked them the question, so for the steps in claim one, you can't do in the courtroom, you have to pretend, right? With this disc, yes. But it's very interesting, Mr. Bradner said that he had an actual disc and it didn't work either. This piece of prior art, or alleged piece of prior art that had a confidential stamp on it and wasn't even purportedly distributed, didn't do what they promised the jury it was going to do, which is to demonstrate that. In addition to that, there was testimony on it.
You may be correct that they had promised that this disc was going to show it and the disc didn't work.
Correct.
But I don't think that equates to being an admission that the Old Parity system didn't have those.
No, I don't think we cited it for the proposition that that was an admission that it didn't have it.
The statement that says that precedes the cite says that quite clearly, unless I'm misreading something.
The disc couldn't be used to demonstrate an actual bid being submitted or displaying information associated with the bid on an issue with computer. nor could it communicate messages associated with the bid submitted by the issuer's computer. That's the
demonstration. That the disk wasn't able to work.
Correct.
Demonstrate that.
Correct.
Not an admission that it did not, that the operating system did not.
That's correct. That's correct. But there are other portions of the record where witnesses, including Mr. Bradner and other witnesses, and Neil and others, testified and showed in detail that lacking from the disk, lacking from old parity, which was before the examiner, not once but twice, there was a withdrawal of the application from issue so that additional information that Thompson had on old parity, they supplied all this information to our client, who in turn gave it to the patent examiner. Every bit of information they provided, they gave to the examiner, our client gave to the examiner. There was no centralized clock, there was no use of a web browser, there was no ranking of bids, there was no outside observer. That's at 42.
Well, let me turn to the interest computing
yes.
aspect of it, that limitation.
Yes.
Other than the patent examiner's statements that were concluded in the file history,
right.
was there any other evidence on record on your side establishing that that was an aspect of the alternative system?
That it was not there? Yes. Well, there was testimony both of Mr. Harrington and, more importantly, of Mr. O'Neill.
The O'Neill testimony you're talking about is the testimony that was subject to cross-examination, and at least from Mr. Rainey's point of view, sort of flipped on that, right?
He was asked some hypotheticals based upon testimony of Ms. Horowitz. She was called as an adverse witness. She testified there was a way, the things that old Perry had. And then he was asked a series of questions, some of which I think are quoted in the brief, all of which are in the record, the essence of which were this. Assume Ms. Horowitz is right. Would you agree?
Can I interrupt? I thought that was in connection with the display element.
It was in connection.
With computation.
It could be both. I don't know. I would have to look, but I think
there was the O'Neill testimony that was in connection with the interest computation.
Right.
And then there was the
displaying
testimony
stuff.
With respect to Ms. Horowitz displaying stuff. So, I mean, I'm open, but I believe
O'Neill
was presented in the brief. So I read the Ms. Horowitz assertion issue as being related to the displaying. But in any event, but in answer to my question, you also cited beyond Mr. O'Neill, you cited something else in your response a few minutes ago.
I believe Mr. Bradner, in his report, he repeatedly said may or may not have it, which is not clear and convincing evidence.
In the
appendix A8243. And 44, there's a side-by-side comparison of Bradner's admissions versus the claim steps.
Mm-hmm.
That was a chart used at the trial and used in cross-examination, Mr. Bradner.
So it's may or may not.
That's right. That's not clear and convincing evidence of the existence of an element, I don't think.
But I asked you, my question was whether there was evidence to support the fact that it didn't have it, so it's may or may not.
Right. Also, there was evidence in the form of the charts and then the examination of Mr. Bradner on those charts at A8252 through A8253, which are in red, some of the claim elements that aren't present. So it was quite a debate as to what was and what wasn't. O'Neill, when faced with some hypotheticals, and he said a couple times, I learned this morning from Ms. Horowitz that this happened. And then he said, so I would agree with this or that. But immediately after that testimony, redirect, he reaffirmed that the elements, four of the key elements in claims 1 and 31, and seven of the elements from the dependent claims were simply not present in the whole parity.
But during cross-examination, he admitted that they were present.
He admitted if you take it outside of the context of the series of questions that were asked, yes, I think you could read it that way, but the reality is he was being asked a whole series of questions predicated on the prior testimony he had heard of Ms. Horowitz. And I think on five separate occasions, he said, well, if Ms. Horowitz is right, if Ms. Horowitz is correct, then yes, yes, yes. The first question he was asked on redirect after he gave that testimony, not before, was, are these features present or not present in old parity, in your opinion? And he said, they are not present. And then he explained why.
Well, with respect to prosecution, claim one, the where-in clause, which added the web browser, was added by Fenton.
Right.
Did not have the web browser added to it until the rejection by the patent.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
And the only reason why that was probably issued by the patent office, from what I could tell, was because all of the steps were shown in old parity, except for the web browser.
I think as to claim,
yeah,
as to claims 1 and 31, the examiner said in his reasons for allowance that he couldn't find anything that showed a web browser or the calculation of automatically calculating the true interest cost. The dependent claims, which are just as important as those independent claims, have a myriad of limitations that aren't present in old parity, such as ordering and ranking the bids, such as bid verification.
Let me ask, hypothetically, if we have a record and all there is an examiner's statement saying what he means by prior art, only this prior art, and then all you have at trial is evidence entirely going the other way, is that sufficient to sustain the examiner's statements in the record correcting the patent?
If there was no evidence in the record other than the examiner's statements,
oh, well, the evidence, I mean, there's evidence going the other way, but nothing on the side of the examiner or the examiner's statements.
Well, that's not our case. But it might be. It might be. I think you'd have to look at the specific facts of the case. But in this case, on obviousness, after KSR, Judge Lancaster made a considered determination of whether or not the obviousness standard had been met, whether there was adequate proof. And he looked at all the Graham factors, apply the Graham factors, and although objective evidence sort of gets swept away here, this case is filled with objective evidence of non-obviousness. When this invention came to light, Thompson and the community said, you can't auction municipal bonds on the internet, that's for selling cars. He was vilified. There was commercial success to the point where they had 100% market share. And as a result of Thompson coming into the market and cutting the prices, it went down to 15%. There was a long-felt need, a solution to a long-felt need problem, commercial success, and copying. We proved at trial that 18 features of their infringing system were identical to ours. And I think my time is up, sir.
I think your time is up, and we'll have to ask. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm hoping I won't need 8 minutes to make these 2 points, but I'll do my best to be prompt. I think we've heard a lot about contracts. I don't think the contracts say anything about that even come close to meeting the standard that the MC sets forth. But I would add, they're not even in the record. They weren't presented to the jury below, at least as far as we can tell. So I don't think they can be used to inform this court's judgment. You pointed that out in our brief.
What do you think of Mr. Nero's distinction between the party with a commercial relationship and the casual bidder? Or to use the Cook example, is there a difference with regard to the agency relationship if the cook is someone who is hired to cook and use the materials and equipment of the restaurant, and a person who comes in on an occasion to cook, having won the privilege at, if you will, a charity auction? Terms of the agency relationship to the restaurant, the latter person bringing his own food, his own equipment. Is there a difference in agency?
There may be. One may be deemed an employee and one may be deemed an independent contractor, for example, just to use
classically.
Yeah, and I think it depends on the facts and circumstances of the situation. You're going to have to find that in order to label someone an employee, that they have consented to being controlled by the company, and that they are acting on for the benefit of the company, and that both sides have agreed to that. And that's a pretty standard formulation for an agency relationship. So I think it depends on the situation. Unfortunately, like everything else,
your situation is.
I think it's very clear. I think it would be, as I said before, it would be rather surprising for the city of Milwaukee to hear in the opinion that it is acting as the agent of Thompson or under Thompson's control when it issues an auction, as would J.P. Morgan Chase and the other investment banks who auction on these, bid on these instruments. On the issue of obviousness, Mr. Nyro mentioned the testimony of Mr. Bradner. And this may or may not testimony, I think we dealt with this in our brief, but I just want to point out, if you look at his expert report and his testimony, what he said is, it may or may not, when I wrote my expert report, depending on the judge's claim construction, it explicitly says that in the expert report, which was written prior to the judge's claim construction. After the judge construed the claims, he testified on direct that all of these limitations were there. There was no admission that elements were missing in the prior art. That's all I have, Your Honor. If you have any further questions.
All rise.